This is a WERU special COVID-19 the vaccine chapter. This presentation was a collaboration between the Ellsworth Public Library and Jackson Laboratory, and it features experts discussing their views of the safety of vaccines and their impact on the course of the pandemic. It was recorded on February 17th. Our thanks to the Ellsworth Public Library and the Jackson Laboratory for making this recording available to WERU listeners.
My name is Abby Morrow, and I'm the Community Engagement Librarian at the Ellsworth Public Library. We're very pleased to work with Jackson Laboratory on this presentation, COVID-19, the Vaccine Chapter. I've been working with Luann Ballesteros, Vice President of External and Government Affairs, to organize this event.
Thanks, Abby. I appreciate it. We're grateful for the opportunity to work with the library on this second session on COVID. Thanks. Off to you, Abby.
Yes, thanks, Luann. And I'd just like to say a quick thank you to Jackson Laboratory, Representative Nicole Grahowski, and Pine Tree Society for joining us tonight. So on to the introductions. Edison T. Liu, MD, is the president and CEO of Jackson Laboratory and the director of the Jackson Laboratory Cancer Center. Dr. Liu joined the Jackson Laboratory from the Genome Institute of Singapore as its founding executive director and chairman of the Health Sciences Authority, which is the FDA equivalent of Singapore. He was previously the scientific director of the National Cancer Institute's Division of Clinical Sciences and professor of medicine, biochemistry, genetics, and epidemiology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and its director for UNC's Specialized Program of Research Excellence in Breast Cancer. His research focuses on the genomics of human breast cancer. Also with us this evening is Jens Ruder, MD. He is the medical director of the Maine Cancer Genomic Initiative and the associate director of the Regional Translational Partnerships of Jackson Lab Cancer Center. Dr. Ruder joined Jackson Lab in August of 2016. He has overseen the implementation of a unique precision medical program that has enrolled physicians and patients statewide across multiple healthcare systems and established statewide genomic tumor boards. Previously, he was a hematologist-oncologist at EMMC Cancer Care and the medical director for EMMC Biobank and translational research in Brewer. After graduating from medical school in Berlin, Germany, he completed his residency in internal medicine at Tulane University. Moderating this evening's discussion is State Representative Nicole Grahowski. Representative Grahowski is serving her second term in the Maine House, representing District 132, which includes the communities of Ellsworth and Trenton. Nicole is a member of the Energy, Utilities, and Technology Committee. She is also a geographic information system specialist and cartographer and works for a small Maine-based mapping company. She grew up in Ellsworth and graduated from Middlebury College, where she studied environmental studies and chemistry with a minor in math. Please join me in welcoming Drs. Liu and Ruder and Representative Grahowski. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Abby, for the introductions and to the Ellsworth Public Library and Jackson Lab for putting on this important event. I know that so many members of our community have a lot of questions about the vaccine, where we are right now, where we're headed with this important work that's happening to protect the public. So I'm so pleased to be a part of this discussion and opportunity. And I think I'd like to start with a question that I think everybody wants to know a bit more about, and that is, how do the COVID-19 vaccines actually work? And I was hoping maybe Dr. Liu, you could start by talking a bit about how so many years of scientific research have helped in the development of these specific vaccines in a relatively short turnaround time period.
So vaccines have been a mainstay of medicines since the 1700s, even though the practice preceded that. And the fundamental to that is to mimic an infection that you want to prevent. So the term is you really want to mimic the infection by using some form that would immunize you, that is to train your immune system against the virus that is much more virulent. So historically, they have been viruses that have been grown. The same virus have been grown and either killed or attenuated, meaning they've been rendered relatively harmless but the protein shells of those viruses are then used to inoculate you so that your body will generate an antibody response that will protect you from a challenge from a live virus. Well, this series of vaccines that have been propagated by the two companies, Pfizer and Moderna, is a radical departure from that, and a radical in a very positive way. It uses, instead of proteins or a virus or a live or a virus that have been attenuated or killed, actually RNA, the genetic material of many of these viruses, synthetically produced so that it encodes for the proteins that you want your body to recognize. And why is this technology so radical and so new and so exciting is that rather than go through a very long process of generating the virus, inactivating virus, testing the what we call the titers of the virus, one can synthesize these RNA molecules in a lab relatively quickly once the sequence of the virus was done. This is precisely the reason why Pfizer and Moderna were among the very first companies to have generated virus against this specific pathogen, this specific virus that has never been seen before, that causing the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, having said that, there are other vaccines that are in the works right now, ones that use other viruses as a Trojan horse, where you still take genetic material from the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which is a virus causing COVID-19, and with that Trojan horse, you generate an antibody response as well. And then finally, there are other groups, and especially the Chinese, that have rapidly expanded the COVID-19, the virus itself, and did it the old-fashioned way, that is to inactivate the virus that is then subsequently given to populations.
Dr. Ruder, did you have anything to add to that specifically about these trials and the time frame of everything?
Just very briefly that, of course, the time frame in which the time span from the discovery of the genetic sequence that Dr. Lu mentioned to this drug actually being FDA approved is very, very short. And it was, I think, primarily possible because of, just a very intense work. This was not done on a 40-hour work week schedule. It just took a lot of effort by many people. And of course, with this urgency of the pandemic, I think everyone just, really got to work and got it done. I will assure everyone that, the typical phases of clinical trials was still kept. And the drugs, both of these vaccines, were studied in the appropriate fashion, really starting with very small trials and finding the right dose and making sure that it was safe to administer to people, and then slowly expanding and then really having a very large clinical trial with over 40,000 participants to really test that it's actually effective and that it actually prevents severe illness and really prevents, can prevent the disease quite effectively. And on top of that, we saw that Pfizer, especially, they really used a very nimble approach of slowly, scaling up this clinical study. So I think it was done in a very safe way. It was done the appropriate way, just on a very, very accelerated timeline. And that was possible because of the special situation that we're in.
Thank you for adding that detail. I've been following along and a little bit with the science and have found with this many brains working together with so many years of background that we've really come to an exciting exciting outcome sooner than I might have expected. So I'm grateful for that. Speaking of effectiveness, Dr. Liu, I was wondering if you could talk about the range of effectiveness between the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines.
Yeah, actually, they're very, very similar. A few percentage points here and there are really irrelevant for these large-scale trials. But to quite frankly, to the surprise of many of us, these two vaccines were in the clinical trials, that is in the field, were effective in preventing infection in between 90 to 96% of the cases. That is really remarkably powerful vaccine. Most vaccines don't get to that level. And in fact, the FDA had stated to the companies that they will not accept any vaccine under 50% effective. So you can see that they've exceeded that low bar or that threshold by a significant amount.
Another question that I hear a lot from people in the region is, you know, what are the possible short-term and the long-term side effects of the vaccine? I was hoping maybe Dr. Ruder could help us understand that.
Sure. So I think first, let's start with the short-term side effects, because I think that's certainly something that we're all concerned about. Primarily, they're really around this issue that you are inducing the immune response, as Dr. Liu mentioned in the very beginning, and that really causes the side effects that we are feeling. So in fact, you know, they're not really side effects; they're just showing us that the vaccine is doing what it's supposed to be doing. So you may have, you may have a little bit of a low-grade fever. You may just feel a little bit achy. Some people have described that they have some mild headaches, but all these are quite short-lived, and they're actually quite more prevalent after the second dose of the vaccine. So the two currently approved vaccines are given two doses, obviously, 3 weeks apart, approximately, and most people have more significant side effects after the second dose. And then in addition, you may have a little bit of soreness at the injection site, maybe a little bit of swelling and redness. But again, these are all really just signs that the vaccine is doing its job. And it's probably not all that different from many other vaccines that we receive on a regular basis.
Any thoughts on long-term side effects, or is it too soon to know?
Well, so I think the we have a little bit of follow-up now. I mean, you know, we should be honest that, of course, these drugs have only been in trials for about a year, or, you know, a little bit less than a year, actually. So it's really hard to say if there are any long-term side effects. However, I think it's also important to recognize that that COVID itself, you know, can have long-term consequences. And at the end of the day, I think we have to balance a little bit of uncertainty with actually quite a bit of certainty that COVID obviously can cause very significant problems to, you know, a relatively large proportion of infected people. So I think that's, we will see if there are any, but so far the safety data that has been analyzed and looked at has been very strong, and there are really no significant issues. You know, one question that comes up, what about allergies? If I had an allergic reaction to another vaccine, well, allergic reactions are really a function of the actual substance that's in the vaccine. And as we pointed out, this vaccine is quite different from sort of the typical vaccines. So really, there shouldn't be any sort of cross-reactivity to other allergic reactions in the past.
Thank you. And I'm really glad you brought up that contrast to what we know about COVID itself. And that was sort of the next question I was thinking of is, we're so focused on the vaccine that I'm not sure that, you know, me as a member of the general public, I'm not paying as much attention these days as to what we now know about the long-term effects of COVID compared to what we knew almost a year ago people like me first became aware of this, I guess. So I don't know, Dr. Wu, maybe you can talk about what we're learning still about the long-term effects of this virus.
Yeah, there's a syndrome called long COVID, which affects people who have cleared themselves of the COVID infection, hoping and thinking that they would just recover, you know, all functions. And it turns out that on a significant number of people, and we don't know exactly that number because it's a new phenomenon that requires a lot more investigation, come down with prolonged effects. Now, they tend to be in four flavors that intermingle. Number one, persistent shortness of breath and coughing, But that shortness of breath may not be a pulmonary or a lung-based problem, but a cardiac problem. And one study from Germany was very distressing to me that showed up to 30% of individuals who were recovering from COVID, actually up to 40% of the individuals, actually had abnormal MRIs of the heart. Now, these may be subclinical in a sense that people are just fine, but I've had personal friends who've had COVID who still say that they're not up to the same sort of vigor as before because they get short of breath. The other aspect is what we call brain fog that's been described before. Individuals have a hard time concentrating, and I've heard this from colleagues who have had this. And then finally, the loss of smell is one of the first signs of COVID infection. And there are some people whose sense of smell don't recover that quickly. And so these are all issues. They may be minor to many people, and I hope that that is the case. But there are individuals with a gradation that moves into some debilitation.
Thank you for the update. I think it really highlights that risk that you were talking about, Dr. Reuter, of the vaccine, but then this illness that's much more serious, I think.
Yeah. I think if you kind of, if I look at it from the perspective of the medical community, I think that what Dr. Liu just described is exactly the reason why, the medical community is very concerned about this. If it was a disease that led to, obviously ICU stays and pulmonary infections and pulmonary, loss of pulmonary function, I think over time we could probably, we will get better at that, and we have gotten better at that. We have now some medications that are actually effective for these severely ill patients. But it is exactly these long-term consequences that just make it a very hard to predict disease. And I think this is one of the reasons why the vaccination effort is so important, because only with these highly effective vaccines, if we can distribute them and if people are able to take them and are willing to take them, I think we can really prevent a lot of illness in the future. And I think that's why they're so important.
Thank you. And this could be because I'm a state representative and it's my business to know, or because I'm just a math nerd, but I find that I really like to check the vaccine counts that are daily posted on the main CDC website. Highly recommend that to anyone interested. And I find it really encouraging to watch them climbing up every day. And I personally feel quite a bit safer knowing that more and more people in our community are protected by the vaccines. And I'm wondering what percent of the population will we really need to vaccinate to stop or significantly slow the spread of the virus? And Dr. Liu, I was hoping maybe you could help with that.
Yeah. To explain this, actually, there's two functions of the vaccine. One is to protect you from dying of the disease, because it protects you from getting the most severe forms of COVID-19. But the second reason why you have population immunization programs is to protect the population. In fact, the uninfected, unvaccinated population, and many of your listeners will have heard the concept of herd immunity. And what it means is that if enough people in the population are immune to the COVID-19 virus, then it is hard for that virus to find a sufficient hosts to then spread to the next host and then the next host. It's like stopping a chain reaction. The reaction will continue, but by spreading those nuclear rods out, pushing the insulators in, you actually stop the chain reaction that occurs. Now, epidemiologists can actually calculate how many people in the population needs to be vaccinated in order to achieve that herd immunity. And it's highly dependent on how virulent or how quickly that virus spreads, and its life cycle as well. But what we know is estimated that about 70% of the population will need to be vaccinated in order to have true herd immunity. Now, let me just reiterate that it doesn't mean that that if less than 70% less than 70% actually get the vaccine, that somehow is ineffective. No, it will protect you, but it just won't have this added benefit to the population of the herd immunity.
Thank you.
You're listening to a WERU Public Affairs special, COVID-19, the Vaccine Chapter, a presentation sponsored by the Ellsworth Public Library and the Jackson Laboratory. It was recorded on February 17th.
I think that your point there that the vaccine is protecting the person who's been vaccinated brings me to the next question, which is if you are vaccinated, can you still get and spread COVID-19? How does that really work? Dr. Reuter, you might have some thoughts, I hope.
Yeah, so when the initial vaccine came on the market, certainly I think everyone was hoping that we could sort of slowly or very quickly, let's put it this way, return to a new normal. But the reality is, as Dr. Liu mentioned, we have this herd immunity issue that we need to address, before we can really kind of get back to a probably slightly different normal, but a less socially distanced normal. What we don't know from the initial studies is exactly how effective the vaccine is at preventing the actual infection and also the spreading to others. We do know that it's very, very effective at preventing disease, meaning preventing people from getting ill. So I think we still have to wait a little bit before we know this. I'm sorry, my WebEx is sort of acting up a little bit here, but I think, so we'll need to wait a little bit longer until we have more detail on that. On the other hand, I think over time we'll also recognize that cases, will go down, and certainly some of the guidelines are already beginning to change, and quarantine rules if you're exposed change, and people are starting to, so some of these regulations are starting to be loosened. So I think we'll have to wait a little bit longer, but certainly I think over time we'll be able to, we'll know more about this.
Yeah, and I appreciate the point there that the guidelines are often changing because we're learning more through the scientific process to help hone in on how to best protect ourselves from this virus. To elaborate on it a little more, I think a lot of people are wondering, after they've been vaccinated, are they still going to have to wear masks and socially distance when they're in public? And then what should they be thinking about when they're with other people who are vaccinated? What level of caution do they need to exercise?
Yeah, I think for now, we should continue to be very, very careful and very, very cautious, just because there are some things that we just simply don't know. And so for right now, I don't think we should really let any of our guards down. I think that would be a mistake. But hopefully, again, in the near future, we can start relaxing things a bit based on scientific, the better understanding of the scientific background. So we'll just have to give it a little bit more time.
So don't go taking your masks off, everyone, quite yet, is what I heard. I'm also hearing some questions about what sort of activities people maybe have been foregoing that after they're vaccinated, they could maybe feel a little more comfortable resuming. Some examples I'm thinking of are air travel, maybe going to the gym, eating out, getting a haircut if you've gone this long. I gave in, I'll admit it, once. So is there any research that's happening that's going to help answer these questions that you're aware of or things we should be waiting to hear about?
Yeah, again, I think over time there will, this all comes back to the same thing. I think over time, we will learn more from the trials that are currently ongoing. We will certainly get more more follow-up data that will help us, really identify exactly what is your risk of transmission, what is your risk of infection. So I think, to a certain extent, again, let's continue to be careful. Let's listen to the public guidelines, from the Department of Public Health, CDC, and so forth. And use common sense, and I think that's really the best way to go about doing this. I don't think there's anything in particular that one can recommend at this time that you can safely resume. But certainly we all have to, you know, we also have to go and live on, live our lives, right, to a certain extent. So I think we just have to be cautious and use common sense and listen to public guidelines. I think that's the most important thing.
Thank you. Dr. Liu, I'm curious if you can talk about other vaccinations that are on their way.
Yeah, we talked about the RNA vaccines, which are, I would argue, revolutionary and going forward will fundamentally change the face of vaccinology in all forms and for the good. There are other others that are coming out along the pipeline. AstraZeneca, Oxford AstraZeneca one and the Johnson & Johnson one, both are what I mentioned earlier, Trojan horse vaccines using adenovirus as a Trojan horse, where the SARS-CoV-2 or the virus that the RNA sequences of that virus have been inserted into that Trojan horse and will be injected in individuals. Both those vaccines in clinical trials have less efficacy in a range of about 66 to 70%. And one could say, well, you know, that's clearly inferior, but it's clear that it protects absolutely against death. And so the severity of the disorder is actually reduced, even though individuals might have a case of the COVID-19. The advantage of, there's some other advantage of both of these is that they don't require these ultra freezing, you know, issues. And I believe the J&J is a one dose as well. So you might think, well, what's the difference? Well, it's a huge difference. If you have to, for especially rural hospitals to have minus 80 degree storage, it's very difficult. It's the cold chain, as we call it, is significant. So the truth is that any vaccine above the 50% mark is better than no vaccine. And that just because you have a vaccine this year, and this is something I'm sure we'll talk about, doesn't mean that you won't have a vaccine next year to protect you against perhaps the next variant or to give you the booster that's necessary, just as much as you get a tetanus booster every 10 years.
Yeah, and that actually was a question I was planning to ask. I don't know if you have any more to add on that, but I think folks are wondering, is this going to be similar to the flu? Are we going to be looking at regular annual vaccines? And maybe we don't know yet, but if you have any thoughts on that possibility?
I'll be honest with you. Inevitably, because this is now it's a pandemic that is endemic, meaning it's everywhere. There is a huge swath of the human population that have not been vaccinated, and their countries are struggling with simple measures, and will not be able to mount a vaccination effort. So, what we're going to be seeing is this virus coming back. I would argue that it's inevitable, and that the key here is for us to be prepared with advanced vaccines that take into account what's circulating in the populations, and also to, quite frankly, we may have to change our certain aspects of our lifestyle. You know, in Asia, wearing masks is a standard procedure in the winter months. I mean, it's just natural that many people wear it. This just hasn't been popular in the West. It may have to be that we'll have to change our approach.
One concern that I hear a lot that I'm sure you're aware of is just how much life has been affected for our younger Mainers, you know, school kids that are in schools, kids that go to childcare. I'm just curious, what we know, and it's a question I'm sure so many parents have, is will children need to be vaccinated? And if so, do we have any sense of when we're going to know that these vaccines are safe and available for children.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. Certainly, as I mentioned, again, there are two reasons why you vaccinate. One is to protect you. The other is protect your community, okay? And children who get infected with COVID usually do not suffer the major consequences of COVID. That is ICU and death. Now, don't get me wrong, there are cases of some serious ramifications of infection, particularly with kids with intercurrent medical problems, other medical problems. But the vast majority of children will not have serious disease from it. But they are a reservoir, and they will pass it around, and they will pass it to the families and to vulnerable people within the family, including their elderly grandparents and so forth. Both Pfizer and Moderna are, by the way, Pfizer, the vaccine is for 16 and up. Moderna is for 18 and up. And both companies are doing clinical trials right now for kids down to the age of 12. Below that, I think there'll be considerations. I'm sure of that. But it's marching down the age group because every age group in the pediatric realm they have different reactions in their immune system that stabilizes really fundamentally when they become adults.
And maybe just to add one other thought to this, I think over time, you know, this relative new technology and vaccinations against COVID, it's going to become very similar to the flu vaccine, right? Which is also, obviously administered to children. So I think that over time we'll be able to do this. It just takes a little bit more time to ensure safety and efficacy at the same time. So I think that's really important.
There are groups also talking about intranasal for a variety of reasons, including the fact that the immune system has a different defense mechanism. They're all interrelated, but a different one against mucosal assaults of viruses using a different form of immunoglobulin. And so that's also being worked on right now.
Every aspect of this conversation just makes me feel like we're still at the tip of the iceberg in so many ways in knowing the long-term effects and the ways that we're going to continue to get through this pandemic. And I'm so grateful to all the scientists who are putting in the extra hours. As you said, it wasn't a 40-hour a week project to get to where we are. As more people have gotten COVID, I think there's a question about if you've had COVID, should you get vaccinated? Is it safe to get vaccinated? Maybe should you wait a little bit before you do and let others get ahead of you in line?
I can answer that. You know, if you had COVID, then getting the COVID vaccine is like getting a booster, right? It fundamentally is a booster. And so the CDC does recommend, regardless of whether you've had COVID or not, that you should get the vaccine. Is it safe? Highly likely to be safe. And given, you know, all the vaccinations people have had in the past and so forth. And there's no indication that people who've had COVID before would have either a more severe reaction or would have serious adverse reactions.
And is it accurate that COVID-19 reinfection is possible? I feel like I hear these rumors, but I haven't had time to really delve into it myself, nor am I the expert.
Jens, you want to answer that?
Well, so the way we currently look at it is that it's highly unlikely within the first 90 days for sure. After the first 90 days, it is possible. And, you know, initially, I would say in the first 3 or 4 months, it was, you know, everyone... The scientific kind of journals did not mention any case reports, and I think they have come up over time. And so currently, I don't think we believe that people are truly safe from reinfection. It's just very, very unlikely within the first 90 days, but then it sort of wears off over time because that natural immunity goes away. So that's the current thinking. I don't know, Ed, if you have any other thoughts on that, but that would be my initial reaction.
No, that's exactly correct. And one of the other issues here is that there is significant variation in the population, all human populations, in terms of how well they respond to any vaccination or lasting immunity in the acute phase, but also how long that this protection will last. It varies in populations. And there, unfortunately, will always be a percentage of individuals who will not get a good response or whose response is not lasting and will get reinfected.
Sort of highlights the importance of as many people getting vaccinated as possible so we can help each other in those cases, I think. One of the things that's become, I think, more concerning, especially knowing now that there's, I think I heard today, two cases in Maine, but there are these new mutations of the virus coming in. I'm curious what you can say about what we currently know about the spread and severity of it, these mutations, and what might be coming down the line. Dr. Liu, I'll start with you.
Yeah, listen, all viruses mutate. And therefore, this is one of the reasons why when this first started, there was such an effort to suppress it and to kill it before it spread and became endemic. Well, it's now endemic. And what it means is that every time it passes through a population, it will find a way to be more infectious, sometimes more aggressive, but most frequently evading elements of the immune system, of your immune system. So we have two variants that we're concerned about as a medical profession right now. One is called B117 from the UK. It looks like it is a super spreader, if you want to call it that. It spreads more actively. There is no specific indication right now that it is more virulent, but it just spreads a lot faster. Now, there's a reason why we're worried about that, because all these issues about herd immunity and is dependent on how fast a virus actually spreads. The faster it spreads, the more you have to immunize a population to achieve a herd immunity framework. The second variant is called B1351, and it's from Brazil primarily and South Africa. And the concern about that is that there were specific mutations that we would expect it to be to evade, to a certain degree, evade the vaccines, the vaccination. Now, everybody's really focusing on whether or not it really does evade and whether or not the vaccinations will work. Preliminary data that I've read, and Jens can comment on this, is that though the protection, the vaccination protection is less against this B1351, that the titers or the levels of antibodies that most people get after a vaccine should be sufficient to protect at least the most severe forms of the virus. Jens, is that your impression too?
Yeah, that's right. That's my impression. And I think with vaccines in general, there is two really important components there. While we design them to the specific sequence, right, that we discussed, especially these RNA vaccines, there's a little bit of redundancy built in so that you can actually kind of absorb these these mutations, even if they're in the critical region of the spike protein and so forth. And then the second one is, I think, exactly, makes perfect sense. You're kind of inducing a very, very strong immune response with the vaccine and a very, very clean immune response, if you will. And so there is certainly that dose effect, right, that you can prevent more severe forms. While you might not be able to prevent infection, you can at least prevent the most severe issues. And I think that's also really important. So again, I think the message is, you know, the more we get vaccinated, the more likely we are as a society to prevent these really severe cases and the significant morbidity from COVID itself.
You're listening to a WERU Public Affairs special, COVID-19, the Vaccine Chapter, a presentation sponsored by the Ellsworth Public Library and the Jackson Laboratory. It was recorded on February 17th.
I was listening to a briefing that Dr. Shaw gave the legislature recently, and that's exactly what he said is we just need to vaccinate as many people as quickly as possible for that reason. And that's why he's been very focused on the larger vaccination sites. And we're absolutely trying to get the vaccines to the more rural areas as well. I heard Aroostook County is actually the most vaccinated right now. And that's even with people from this region driving up there on occasion, as rumor has it. But it does seem like such a focus to just get every vaccine that comes into the state into people as soon as we're able to. Something that what you mentioned earlier, Dr. Ruder, was that how much does the vaccine really protect folks? And I think people might be wondering, you know, is it worthwhile to get an antibody test to see if they've been protected, or is that something that's going to inundate the medical system and maybe they should just trust it?
Yes, you go first. You go, please.
Okay.
Please.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, so it theoretically makes a lot of sense, right? You can sort of determine your own level of protection. But at the same time, the problem is that none of the currently available antibody tests are really a good indicator of whether or not you are truly protected. So there is still a lot of uncertainty around this. And certainly also just coming back to the actual science and the clinical trials, the trials weren't really designed based on that parameter. So they really looked at these clinical outcomes, meaning how many people are getting infected. And I don't recall reading the original publication that they had any correlation with antibody tests, for example, in those people that were protected. So it doesn't really change anything at the end of the day. That would be my response. And so I wouldn't encourage it. Having said that, they are available. You know, they are clinically validated. They are, you know, appropriate. They're good, you know, good laboratory tests, but I'm just not sure that we can really draw clinical conclusions from it. That would be my interpretation. Ed, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, one of the challenges is that an antibody test is not they're not all the same. And so most of the ones are non-quantitative. They just give you yes, no. And we know for a fact as clinicians and scientists that everything to do with an antibody is what level is it? What level is it? And that level is also protective depending on your viral load that was thrown to you. You know, if the viral load is low, your immune system, if you had antibodies, may protect from that onslaught. But if you had just an overwhelming viral load, then even that same protection won't do. And this is the vagaries that Dr. Ruder mentioned. There have been some studies, however, they're not perfect, but that suggest individuals that are antibody positive will have subsequently a significant, a finite and significant reduction in the rate of being positive. But as Dr. Ruder mentioned, in no way does it ensure that somebody will not be infected. And I think that is the difference here. You know, if you want the antibody to be an insurance policy, unfortunately, that's not going to get you there. If you want the antibody test to just see your relative risk, maybe. If you want the antibody to just ask the question, am I tired because I've had COVID before? Yes, that might be helpful. But at that point, the cat's out of the bag.
Speaking of the cat out of the bag, the last question that I had in this section was sort of the crystal ball, or maybe you can let the cat out of the bag, about what your predictions are for COVID-19 in the rest of 2021. The phrase, will the virus ever go away, might not be appropriate based on our conversation, but how do you see life going, I guess, as we get more and more people vaccinated?
Yeah, maybe I let Jens do the first crack at the medical component, and I can put my CEO hat on in terms of what it will do to both the economy and how we operate.
Well, I think the question is medically, what will the vaccine do, or what will this look like, right, in a few months? Overall, the main issue that we're all struggling with right now is that we only have a finite capacity of critical care beds, right? And that, as we know, some people are getting critically ill. So I think a lot of the policies and the guidances are sort of structured around avoiding kind of hospitals being overflooded with severely ill patients. So I think that certainly over time, as vaccines become more prevalent, cases go down, this will become less of an issue. So I think that we will kind of learn to, the medical system will learn to adapt to that. I think the other thing, of course, that's not as clear is, are these sort of long-term effects, this long COVID that I'd mentioned earlier. I think we'll have to sort of see how that kind of, all pans out. So I think those are kind of the two things that I would think about. And certainly, I would say that we have, Ed mentioned, for example, the masks earlier, right, that are quite prevalent in Asia, not so much in the Western hemisphere. And I think people are going to be more cautious moving forward, when in terms of large group gatherings and maybe mask wearing will become a much more common theme, in the near future. So those are my initial thoughts. Ed, I'd love to hear your CEO version of the answer.
maybe not the CEO, but I lived through the SARS crisis in Singapore, being the senior scientist who was responsible for the COVID response, along with the military and with the civil service and the healthcare system. So I knew from the ground up, in an entire country, what it took to get to a certain point. But an important part of it is that they took the lessons learned, and then each successive epidemic that came through, the response was better and better. Now, what do I mean by that? Remember, most of the people in this panel won't remember, and I remembered because it was in high school, that I used to be able to walk up to a terminal in an airport and bring my bag on, and nobody asked a question. Okay, that just won't happen, and it won't happen because of 9/11. One event changed the course of how we conducted aviation, in the world. Okay, and we're not going back. And so I think this is going to be a new reality for us, that in the consciousness of both policymakers, healthcare individuals, and the population, that we know these pandemics are serious. And they're serious not only in health, but they really affect the course of economic well-being as well. So there's going to be a TSA for health. I can almost assure you that that's going to be the case. And we're just going to have to, number one, adjust to it, and adjust to it in a way that will not stop the economy, won't stop your ability to take a vacation. TSA has not stopped my ability to take a flight after 9/11 to see my loved ones. Okay, and I don't think that's going to happen, but it will take extra precautions to go forward. In terms of the workplace, I think that's even a little more a crystal ball gazing, but there are already signs that that the virtual world, that is the web-based business framework of communications, is going to have a greater role than the physical transactions. We've seen it very much at the Jackson Labs. That isn't going to go away, not because it is such an inconvenience. On the contrary, we find that going online was even more convenient in many ways than having to take a plane, flying, taking 4 hours or 8 hours to get to some place, and only to have your hotel reservation canceled, right? And so that is fundamentally going to change how business is conducted. But equally important, it opens up whole new vistas. The vista of security, about pathogen security, the whole vista about telehealth, the whole vista of e-commerce in services, in services rather than financial transactions, I believe will be a reality as the tools get better and better. I see some questions already online, Luann. What do you think of vaccine certificates?
That's one I just zeroed in. So yeah, the question is, what do you think about vaccination certificates? Would it be ethical to use them to allow or disallow certain activities? And I don't know. I think we start with Jens on that one.
You know, technically, we already have these certificates, right? So I actually had received vaccinations because I'm still seeing patients, and you get a little card that from the CDC that actually states when you are vaccinated with what vaccine and the lot number and the whole thing. So that's essentially, in my opinion, a vaccination certificate. Now, whether or not it can allow and disallow certain activities, I think that's a really great question. I think over time, we may become more differentiated in sort of how we're approaching, individuals, right, with respect to someone who had COVID, didn't have COVID, who was vaccinated, didn't get vaccinated. But of course, that is, we have to be very careful there, because obviously there are some concerns about restricting people's ability to do the things they want to do. So I think it's a very interesting question. I don't have a good answer on that. So Ed, I don't know if you have any thoughts.
I'm going to be a little more direct. I mean, it's okay. Look, you cannot go on a flight without a security check. Yeah. You just cannot. And I pay extra to be in a TSA pre-check. And to do that, I have to have my fingerprints done and a background check. That is a certificate of security, okay? And so I suspect that it's going to happen. Of course, there are choices, but the choice will be convenience. There's also a very interesting, I just read an article in whether it's Atlantic or some other magazine that is suggesting that in dating sites, okay, they're now signing off, I'm vaccinated, okay, are you, okay? So we don't have to have a government intervene. People are going to intervene to feel more safe going forward.
Great. This is a question about the ingredients in the Moderna vaccines. Have the ingredients in the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines been in other vaccines? In other words, have humans had these ingredients in vaccines before?
I can tell you this, that humans have had every component of these vaccines before, but not necessarily as vaccines per se, okay? And furthermore, some of the, particularly the RNA, the RNA vaccines have been primarily used in the context of cancer vaccines. Okay, and so the difference here is that cancer vaccines treat a much smaller number of individuals than a vaccine that's supposed to treat billions of human beings. So why is this important? When you're treating a small number of individuals, potentially individuals who are very sick, you don't see a lot of the side effects by numbers or because it's masked by other illnesses. When you treat normal individuals in the billions, you will see some of the side effects come out. So,
yeah, and also I think the sort of very practical question here is should you be concerned, right? And so the answer is actually, if you've had a severe allergic reaction in the past, you're carrying around an EpiPen, right? You've been told you need to carry around an EpiPen. I think it would be very important to look at the exact ingredient list, and it's available online, and make sure that you're not, you know, allergic to any one of the ingredients, because allergy is a very complicated matter, and so I think it definitely should be taken seriously. And the people that had severe allergic reactions in the clinical trials, there were some, but that's not unexpected. They all, either all or the majority of these individuals actually had EpiPens because they had had a severe allergic reaction in the past. So I think it should not be discounted. But what is not in these vaccines, and that's really important, is, you know, it's not an egg-based vaccine like the flu vaccine is, for example. So that's a much more common allergy. So that's not an issue, but it doesn't mean that there is no risk. So it has to be looked at in detail if you've had a severe reaction in the past.
And one point I think should be emphasized is that some of the dangers of previous vaccines is because these are viruses. Mm-hmm. Some of them were live viruses that are called attenuated. And there's always a concern because it's a biological. There's no biological units within this. It never went through a tissues, which can have other factors that have been carried along. So theoretically, and again, this is, I stress the term theoretically, these RNA vaccines could be safer than the biological vaccines.
So I assume folks can jump off if they're, you know, we're a little bit past eight, but there's one more question. Since we talked about crystal balls, and the question is, do you have a crystal ball for education? What's the vision for education post-COVID?
Jens, you have kids in school, so.
Well, yeah, I do have kids in school, but I think actually it comes back a little bit to what Ed said earlier about businesses and using, you know, these tools like WebEx and Zoom and so forth. And I could imagine that to a certain extent that's going to stay in education as well. Now, having said that, I personally believe, and I think many others do as well, that in-person education is very important, especially for primary school aged children. And it's probably important in every part of education, right? But I think it will have to be sort of a nuanced approach that you introduce more online sessions, but yet still keep some of the human, you know, the human interaction, the in-person interaction available. That would be my opinion on this. So I don't know if that's really a crystal ball, but at least it's a starting point.
I can jump in on this having with grandkids and tell you that my oldest granddaughter is 11, and she said the worst thing about COVID is we'll never have a real snow day again.
Oh, she is so smart. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Whoa. Well,
yeah.
Whoa. That is really impressive.
Well, listen, unless Ed, you want to add a couple more comments about your crystal ball vision for education, I think this has been great. You guys have all been wonderful. Nicole, you've been a fabulous moderator. Thank you so much for the signing. You've been fascinating to watch. Abby, once again, thanks for this opportunity to partner with the library.
Thank you, Luann. And thank you all for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a WERU Public Affairs special, COVID-19, the Vaccine Chapter, recorded on February 17th. Our thanks to the Ellsworth Public Library and the Jackson Laboratory for making this available to WERU listeners. This is Amy Brown. Stay tuned to your community radio station, WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, and streaming online at weru.org.